brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Soft Rep Radio, on time, on target. I hope you guys enjoyed that last interview with Rob O'Neill. It seems to be getting some great feedback. If you haven't checked it out already, we got into some really important stuff like Osama bin Laden, which Rob had a lot to say about, like he sees him as the future leader of that movement, possibly. If you guys didn't see the Instagram clip, actually, on at Soft Rep Radio, I think Rob made a pretty interesting point where he was like, unlike ISIS, Al-Qaeda is not into beheading videos and stuff. He said his quote, and you can listen back, was like, ISIS will, you know, chop your head off and put it on YouTube or put it on the internet. He's like, Al-Qaeda will stab you in the back and, you know, you'll feel the effects of it like 10, 20 years later. And he was like, just like they tried to hit the towers before, they were unsuccessful, came back a few years later and 9/11 happened.
Yeah, Al-Qaeda, at least in the past, they showed a propensity for long-term strategic planning. So I guess Rob is correct in that aspect. ISIS, like, you get the feeling they didn't really have a long-term plan. Like they really believed that they were going to like carve out this caliphate in the Middle East, and it was just going to sweep across the world, like that sort of revolutionary fervor. But Al-Qaeda, they'll kick back and wait. They're smart. Now, how much we've degraded them since 9/11, I think we've probably, you know, torn a pretty good chunk out of them, but I wouldn't count them out either.
And also, Osama bin Laden, I did check, now being 30 years old, that's a pretty good time to rise to power. When you look at Kim Jong-un, right around that time frame, I think there are a lot of leaders who rise to power around that 30-year age mark.
With bin Laden and Zawahiri out of the picture now, I'm sure whatever's left of Al-Qaeda is going to be looking for a charismatic leader, right? Somebody who can draw in new recruits, who can keep the movement alive, someone who has propaganda value. He's the, you know, a descendant of bin Laden, so there's some natural succession there.
And as Rob said, some anger over the drone strike that killed his brother, as well as his other brother who was killed in the room with his father, I believe.
Yeah, maybe not in the room, but Rob would know better than I would.
Rob said that, I think he said it was his brother, he said, was killed approximately 8 seconds before Osama. I believe he said his brother.
Because
bin Laden had a ton of kids. I mean, it was a crazy number.
Yeah. So it would make sense that they were searching for somebody who could serve as, you know, like al-Baghdadi was for ISIS. And that's al-Baghdadi's another interesting subject. Where did he go?
Yeah.
That's getting on a whole other subject, but you know, we reported back in the day that he was just a sort of mythological figurehead, that he wasn't part of the real leadership. And you notice how we just stopped hearing about him.
Yeah.
Allegedly he was killed. Maybe not. New audio tapes come out. It's like he just wasn't that important at the end of the day.
Cause I do remember hearing that he was killed in a drone strike, but then there was controversy over the authenticity of it.
Right. I think he was declared dead a number of times, actually.
Yeah. But it was interesting. If you listen back, I think you guys will get something out of that interview for sure. And Rob also said, since you mentioned al-Zawahiri, according to Rob, he said he feels he didn't have the charisma of an Osama bin Laden as a leader.
That's true.
And he's like, I think Osama will be a more charismatic leader.
Yeah. I don't know enough about his son or, you know, and we haven't seen what he's capable of yet, I don't think. So remains to be seen, but yeah, I definitely wouldn't want to discount it or underestimate what's happening there.
Well, we have our friend CJ Ramon coming on this episode. Very excited for it. It's been a while since he's been on. I think he's going to give us an exclusive announcement, which it'll be interesting. But before we get into that, of course, we want to mention or get into the mosque shooting in New Zealand.
Yeah, we had a couple things happen, you know, pop off while I was out for a week. Or while I wasn't out, but you guys were continuing on with some other podcasts.
Rob and then Christian Beck pre-recorded.
And, the mosque shooting, I wrote about it. Stavros wrote about it on NewsRep. I wrote a whole piece about eco-fascism because the guy, the shooter, was a self-proclaimed eco-fascist. And that's a whole weird philosophy in of itself. But it's something that I had studied a little bit in the past, studying, far right movements. And I know you're not allowed to say far right anymore. That's like a trigger word for, the snowflakes out there on the right. You're not allowed to say far right or talk about extremist right wing people or organizations. Because as we have now, the internet has explained to me, anything that's bad is left wing. All of it.
Yeah, I saw you going back and forth.
Very convenient how that works.
Yeah, I saw you going back and forth with people on this on Twitter. I mean, some of it I understand. I mean, it'd be a much bigger discussion not to get into. But I mean,
yeah, it's a whole
other podcast. Some people do, and I'll be honest. I know you and I are like in disagreement on this one. Would define the left-right spectrum as the far left being a very large government. A socialist government or communist government, and then the far right being almost anarchism or no government. And I know that people define these things differently, but purely from an economic standpoint, that's how a lot of people.
From an authoritarian standpoint, I mean, there are differences between communist and fascist economies.
For sure.
But if you were to study those regimes from the perspective of authoritarianism, I mean, fuck yeah. I mean, Nazism and communism is pretty damn close, right? Yeah.
I don't know anything, though, to be fair, which you do, obviously, about eco-fascism. I never heard the term until this shooting.
Eco-fascism is a specific sort of ideology, which the ecology of it, the ecology of fascism, the way they see it, is that the land needs to be preserved, but it needs to be preserved for and by the white race. So you're conserving the environment, you're preserving the natural environment for the white man, and protecting it from invaders or whatever crazy shit. This guy literally called them invaders in his manifesto. But in other words, anyone who's not white. This is also goes back to blood and soil, which is another neo-fascist, neo-Nazi term. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. It's kind of weird, and it's like one of those just strange philosophies that probably a lot of people aren't aware of. But I wrote this whole article about it. What it kind of says, it just says, that it goes into the whole white nationalism philosophy as well, that, you're creating a country, you're creating a nation for white people, that it's being preserved for white people. And it rejects the sort of urban cosmopolitanism or multiculturalism that we pretty much have today in America. So it's a
although this is New Zealand.
This is in New Zealand. And interestingly, this guy was pretty obsessed with American politics, and I could speculate why that is. But he was an Australian who committed the attack in New Zealand.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm just saying this is why it's interesting, because it's New Zealand doesn't have the same dynamic as us in terms of multiculturalism. It's not exactly the same.
You could look up the demographics, but they do have an indigenous population of Pacific Islanders, the native people of New Zealand. I'm going to embarrass myself. Are they the Maori?
I don't know.
I believe that's the indigenous people of New Zealand are Maori. But I could be wrong. I'd have to check on that. But they're not exactly a melting pot, perhaps, in New Zealand. But I mean, they still have and the presence of these mosques, and there is like New Zealand. I think I read somewhere it's like 0.05% Muslim. Like it's a very very small Muslim minority, but they do have,
which is probably though comparable to many states in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, because where we live in New York, or if you live especially in like Detroit, there's a large Muslim population in a lot of these urban areas.
We have a lot of misconceptions in America, especially people like me who grew up in the New York you know, suburbs.
Yeah.
We tend to think that America is like 50% black, because that's kind of what we grew up with. A fairly large black population, fairly large Hispanic population. So we tend to think it's like half and half, and it's not. America is like, what, 6% black?
That I'd have to look up. But it's also, and this is like a recruiting tool of the white supremacists, is like a fading white population.
Right, that you're being replaced.
A lot more Asians, a lot more Latinos.
That was the New Zealand Shooters Manifesto. It's called the Great Replacement, and it's this right-wing conspiracy theory. Extreme right-wing. Okay. When I say these things, I'm not talking about Republicans or conservatives.
Sure,
I feel
sure.
like I have to throw this caveat out, because people just go apeshit. They can't handle you saying this stuff.
And you're also talking about a worldwide thing. So you're not talking about people who are about preserving the American Constitution, for example.
Right. Exactly. That's not at all what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who are on the fringe right. This guy believed in that far right-wing conspiracy theory that white people are being replaced, and that it's a deliberate plot being waged against the white man by the Jews and, you know, the globalist conspiracy to replace us. Those sentiments, those ideas are very hard to fight. And, you know, I think the left in general, I think even the Democrats and moderate Republicans or moderate, someone like myself would probably be considered like center right. I think collectively we all do kind of a bad job in countering those, white nationalist ideas. What we tend to do is want to like shut them down, curtail their speech. We just make a lot of silly arguments. I think we could fight it a lot better and a lot smarter than we do.
The weird thing is that it's like the natural order of where things are going, and that these guys think is problematic, that people in you and I don't. Like it is true that altogether, I think all countries are becoming darker because there's a lot more racial mixing that just goes on. There's not a stigma against being in a mixed couple and having mixed children.
What country? there are some countries where it is not cool. There are some states where it is not cool.
More westernized countries, let's say, and certainly, I mean, it's just, I think, you know, in New York, you're seeing a more migration of Latinos, for example.
Yeah, dude, but
more mixed race couples.
You can't use New York City as a template for what is happening.
No,
in
but
this
I do think just altogether, you probably will see a lot less purely white people in America. And there are people like you and I who are okay with this. I really don't care about the color of people in America. And then there are some that see this
as
an attack.
You have
to
be careful too when you use that term, purely white people, because there's really no such thing. And if you start doing DNA tests on people, you find out that there's no such thing as a pure white, pure Caucasian. Like, we're all a mixture of various European ethnicities with other, you know, Asiatic or African or Native American. I mean, it's all mixed in there at a certain point. Like, there's the whole like neo-Nazi ideology that there's some like pure white race, there's some pure bred, pure blood. Like, that's not a real thing.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of people, and this is so funny because
who look white.
This. Yeah, and I'm also just saying that people who have mixed race couples who have children, they tend to look darker. I mean, our former president, President Obama's mother is white. If I saw President Obama in the street, I would identify him as a black man.
Right.
You know, so it's just that the future of this country are more people who look like President Obama who may have a white parent, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's because you point out globalization and different populations mixing with each other. You know, hundreds of years ago, people didn't travel further than 20 miles from their house.
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't going far. Every village had its own little specific dialect. Now today we live in a very fast-paced, more cosmopolitan world, and people are meeting each other and mixing together, and this is a natural outgrowth of our technological development. Now, for me, I don't give a shit what the color of the person's skin is. What's interesting or important to me is that the idea of America is preserved, and that it continues, and that the concepts that are outlined in our Constitution, in our Bill of Rights, are preserved. Now, if the people doing that preservation are white or black or something in between, I don't really give a shit.
Yeah.
The important is that the American philosophy is preserved.
I agree fully. Before we bring on CJ real quick, and we'll get to emails after, you also wanted to bring up the Robert Mueller investigation, which is, you know, falling apart at this point. And it's really the end of it.
Well, it's falling apart from what perspective? I mean, from the people who hyped it and made something up out of
media.
It. You could argue that, you know, Robert Mueller just did his job.
Yeah, right? No, I just mean the people who hyped week after week told us Trump was gonna be impeached. Trump was going to not serve out a full term.
Yep, and they hyped it up for entertainment value and to get the ratings, all that stuff, and nothing came of it, or almost nothing came of it, right? I guess they got some indictments out of it of some, you know, fairly bad people like Manafort. Flynn went down for the count. You know, a bunch
Roger
of other,
Stone arrested.
Jerome Corsi,
friend of the show, Roger Stone. I would love to have Roger Stone back on.
So, yeah, man, I mean, I read this op-ed in the New York Times today, actually, that was pretty good, saying, you know, we've all been made fools of again, because we just treated this subject as, you know, a soap opera and just spun it out of control. And, you know, the press is guilty of this. They should have been more objective. They should have set their emotions aside, but they just jumped in with both feet and they did the public a disservice.
And Trump did a good job of antagonizing them on Twitter with
absolutely,
the witch hunt
absolutely.
Every 2 seconds.
He played it up. And, you know, what they did, what the media collectively did, was they made Trump's claims about fake news a self-fulfilling prophecy. And they have no one else to blame for that but themselves.
Yeah. Fully agree, man. All right. Well, with that, we'll get to emails after the interview. But let's bring on friend of the show, CJ Ramon.
I'm gonna miss these CD nights.
On the show for the first time in quite a while is a great friend to the show, CJ Ramon, bass player for the legendary Ramones from 1989 on, replaced, of course, Dee Dee Ramon for people who are fans of the band, which is, you know, so many people, retired Marine. And I think the really cool thing is all these writers who come on board on the site really dig it when you end up tweeting them, because I know you read the site all the time, and they're like, man, the bass player for the Ramones, you know, likes my stuff, and it's cool, because I know you're an adamant reader of everything we do, and like I appreciate it, man, and we all appreciate it.
Hey, that, you know, my angle on the whole thing has always been warriors, people who have served, you know, our perspective is really unique. You know, I think people in general who have witnessed, you know, violence on an extreme scale, and people who have just trained together, learned to work as a unit, that real team thing, our perspective is so different than the average person who pretty much, like, lives for themselves or, their, you know, their family in general. But there's always a family tie or something like that. We're forced. Our family in the military is kind of forced on us. So our perspective is unique, and that's why I really dig a lot of the writers, that because of that perspective.
Yeah, no, thank you, CJ. I feel that, you know, especially when we have this ongoing war, it's just really important to keep all this stuff kind of at the forefront of people's minds on a day-to-day basis, and not just let it be forgotten that we have all these guys being deployed overseas. And just what last week we had two soldiers killed in Afghanistan.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's the other thing that I really think about what you guys do, is there's no glorification of it. And that to me is like a really important thing to try to get across to people, because it's very easy, especially for some of the younger guys who are, you know, high school, looking forward to going into the military and stuff like that, really easy for them to get caught up in the, you know, the romanticized, you know, glory hound kind of thing. And that's exactly what we don't want, because any real warrior, anybody who knows what it actually entails, will tell you that they never want to see war. They don't want to see their friends killed. They don't want to lose limbs and everything else and spend the rest of their lives fighting off PTSD and just trying to keep themselves alive. That's what we don't want. You don't want to get put that kind of message out there like, yeah, war is great. And yeah, I think you guys do a really solid job of that.
100%. That means a lot. Thank you.
Yep.
So I wanted to get into what you've been up to, which is a whole lot. As I know, you have a pretty big announcement to make, and we'll save it for a little bit. But the big thing for the big thing for people listening and people who follow you is you have a new album, The Holy Spell, which releases May 10th. Correspondent right. tour with me and Jeans, which right now is like a smaller tour, mostly West Coast states. I know you're going to add to that, but tell us about the new album, man.
So, just a couple months back, I jumped in the studio, 21 days straight, 20 songs.
Wow.
Just really hammered out a record, like old school style. These days, most people don't spend that much time in the studio. It's with digital music now, you could do pretty much anything from your laptop at home. But I'm from the old school, so I went down to LA, went to the studio where I recorded my last record, a neat little place called Buzz Bomb Studios. And slept on the couch in the control room for 21 days, except my wife came up and visited me, so I had one weekend off. But knocked out the record. The first single just came out a couple weeks back. It's called Blue Skies. It's up on YouTube and all that good stuff, and you can get it on Fat Records website too. But the release date is April 10th.
Yeah, it was like May 10th.
Actually May 10th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know your release date better than you, bro. No.
But it's really my record company who is you know, puts out a lot of bands and big label. I'm just one artist on there. But even the guy who I work with over there was like, wow, dude, this album just is kind of like heads and shoulders above everything else you did. So
that's awesome.
Everyone always says, oh, my new album's the best thing I ever did. But I really think this is it. So
you're proud of this one?
Yeah. I'm really proud of it. I actually, we've got a bunch of extra songs left over too. So those will either come out as an EP next year, or we might just put them out like on little collector singles or something as time goes by.
Are you playing everything on this album, or did you work with anyone?
Because I was in the studio so much, I ended up playing a lot of guitar on it, as well as bass, singing, and the background vocals. I went with my man Steve Soto last year, who was with me from the get-go, and he was kind of my go-to guy for harmonies and helping me out with some arrangements and stuff. So this one was a little bit of kind of uncharted territory for me to have to do some of that stuff on my own. But I brought my usual guys in. I had Dan Root from the Adolescents. He came in. He does almost all the solo work. And then a friend of mine, Nate Sander, who's the youngest guy in the group. He's from New York. Young musician, but trained. He's like a great utility guy. Plays everything: guitar, violin, trumpet, piano. Wow. So he's like my utility guy. We got Pete Sosa on drums from the Street Dogs, a band from up in Boston. And we just got in there and hammered out a really great record.
Awesome, man! And you just moved out there to California pretty recently.
Yeah, actually last July I moved my family out, and then I had to jump out on the road and came back about a month later. But we've been out here ever since, and a little bit of culture shock at first. But
I was going to ask.
I was stationed out here at Pendleton, so it wasn't too bad. But Northern California and Southern California are like two different countries, so it took a little bit of getting used to, but it's all right.
What's the difference? Because I have only been out to California a couple times, but like all the guys I know between NorCal and SoCal, they're always at each other's throats about something.
Yeah, it's funny. But as best I can tell, Southern California is lowbrow. Northern California is highbrow. That's really the only difference I see.
Oh, it's the north-south divide. Wow.
Yeah, but I tell you, it's like you got Rancid and Green Day both were from up here. That, and Rancid especially is kind of like real kind of street-level punk rock, you know. High-level players, but street-level attitude. But, yeah, that to me, that seems to be the biggest difference. It's kind of like Southern California's lowbrow, Northern California's highbrow, and they both thumping their chests over it.
You've done a pretty insane amount of touring in the past couple of years, I'd say, and like all over the globe. I mean, from Spain to Cuba. And like, how much of a shock is it to you for you to go to some of these countries and see like that the Ramones still have this giant following, and they just want to hear those songs from a guy who played with them?
Yeah, it's a really strange thing, man. It seems like the Ramones kind of found their way into every little dark corner in every little country. And I mean, like you said, you know, we went to Cuba. I've been to every little tiny. I played more towns in Brazil than any other international artist, except one dude from England who actually lives over there now.
Wow.
But, I mean, I've been to Venezuela. We've been to Japan. We've been to Australia, New Zealand, like every little nook and cranny. And everywhere we go, there's always Ramones fans. And it's such a bizarre thing, man. Ramones music is like a weed. You know what I mean? It just pops up everywhere, and even in places you don't want it to. But it's bizarre. It's somehow the Ramones came to represent America, like in all these places that had no, no, you know, the only two things they knew about America was like, you know, Coca-Cola and the Ramones. just bizarre.
Are there any places that you're like, wow, I wish I really didn't have to play here? Like you end up in like Transnistria or Bratislava or some weird place that you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. We've been a couple of places off the map where it was rough, and we still tour, like, you know, we tour like the Ramones never had a tour bus. They had a van, and that's exactly how I do it. So like, we've gone through some like small towns in like Poland where literally like we could have gotten to a really bad situation, and not because people were after us, but between the people in the crowd. We've been through some pretty hairy situations, but you know, it's punk rock. That's just how it is. You know what I mean? There's a certain element of danger that comes along with going to a punk rock show.
Yeah, for sure, man. I think that's so cool though, that the Ramones still have this giant legacy. I think some of it, obviously the music is a huge part of it, but I even think the logo itself has just become so immortal.
Yeah.
And I think it's like that with a lot of bands. I mean, it's a weird thing now, because I know you've seen it before, like these 13-year-old kids wearing Nirvana shirts and AC/DC, Def Leppard. They don't even know a song by them. There was a video on Instagram that went around of like Kim Kardashian wearing a Morbid Angel shirt. Like, do you think Kim Kardashian really has ever listened to Morbid Angel or any death metal, or it was just like, this is a cool looking badass shirt, you know?
Yeah. You know, funny enough, I just went to a Justin Timberlake concert.
With who? Why were you there?
Say again?
Why were you there? With one of your kids?
A good friend of mine is actually one of the techs. He's a tech for one of Justin Timberlake's guitar players.
Got you. Okay.
So my buddy called me up and was like, hey, I'm going to come into town. Justin's coming to town. You want to come to the show? So I said to my wife, I go, do you want to go out to a show? She was like, yeah, sure. So we went, we go to the show. He comes out on stage wearing an Acid Eater shirt, which is one of the albums that I played on. And, so we stood there and watched the whole show. At the end of the show, as they're, you know, taking their bows, he comes over to stands right in front of me and like shakes his shirt off at me, you know what I mean, and gives me the thumbs up. I was like,
oh wow.
And you know, listen, you know, Justin Timberlake's music, far from what I do and everything else, but it's kind of cool when another artist from that level
Yeah.
Kind of gives you like the nod, like, and he's known to be a cool guy. I've never heard anybody say anything bad about him, like anybody in the business. I've heard a lot of crap talked about a lot of artists from people that work for him, but I've never heard anybody say anything about this guy other than he's totally cool. So I was like, wow, that's, he didn't even have to do that. You know, that was kind of cool that he came over.
That's cool. He was actually a fan.
Not even that he, you know, came over to pay respects to me, but he came over to pay respects to the band, to the Ramones name, and that's what I dug.
Yeah, he wasn't just wearing the shirt.
Right, exactly. I know Kanye West for a little while was wearing the Mondo Bizarro t-shirt, and people were like, oh, he's not even a fan and blah, blah, blah. But it's funny, like, my buddy who works for Justin Timberlake's camp told me, he was like, yeah, that dude's a Ramones fan, man. He's not just a t-shirt wearer. I was like, ah, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you don't know nowadays. That's the way you put it. Like, you don't know who is a t-shirt wearer and who is an actual fan, because it's become so popular. I've seen the same thing with Kanye West has worn a ton of, like, punk rock or old, like, New York hardcore, you know, stuff. And I like Kanye's music, actually, but, like, you do wonder, does he actually listen to any of this, or did it look cool?
Yeah, right. Because, you know, these guys all got stylists and stuff like that that, you know, somebody that picks their wardrobe for them, what they wear on stage. So you don't know if, you know, somebody's just dressing them up or if they dig it. But I got to say, you know, that if you were around popular music in the 80s and the 90s into the 2000s, when you had rap metal crossover bands and, you know, and funk punk crossover, all that stuff, people really kind of got a lot more, people became less of like a genre fan and more of a, people became more like music fans. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I've been blessed with my whole life, is I've always been able to appreciate all music. I dig all music. And it seemed like in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, when you had all those crossover bands coming out, a lot more people got that way. So it kind of makes sense. Justin Timberlake's from that time period. Conway West, maybe a little bit later, but, you know, he's probably just been exposed to more music because of the level that he's at.
Well, it's interesting because your career spans, I feel like, in my uneducated opinion, this is just a casual observation from the outside, that period of time where, like, music went through, the industry itself went through drastic changes with the internet and everything else that happened.
Yeah, absolutely. That was like the real last big revolution in music. That was the last time where you had a huge change in music, a big, big turnover. And, you know, unfortunately, like, you know, like it seems like everything else, it just kind of got, you know, I think once like big companies and stuff figure out what's cool and how to exploit a market, you know, when it's really young or really new, once that happens, there's less and less of a chance of there being like a big spontaneous breakout like that, because, you know, they want to control everything. And that, I say they, but, you know, the music industry tries to control as much as they can of what goes on in music, because that's how they squeeze their dollars out of it. But now it's a weird situation, you know, with ever since the 2000s there with the file sharing thing and everything, that whole business model got destroyed and there wasn't one to follow up. So that's why it's like kind of weird now. You hear like a good band now and again, or a good song now and again, but there isn't that little organic thing where a scene starts in the city and it grows and it matures and you get a whole bunch of good bands and that style of music takes over. That don't happen anymore.
What do you think?
It may in the future, but right now it ain't happening.
What do you think the trajectory is, or like what the potential is for, you know, that young kid, those young kids in their garage trying to start a band? Like, what if they were to be a success? What do you think that might look like in, you know, 2019?
So realistically now, kids have a lot more access to the public in general directly than they used to have.
Yep.
It takes, you know, without that kind of, like back in the day, it would be You know, you start a band, your friends start a band, you find a club, you start playing in that club. All of a sudden, a bunch of other kids in the area get inspired by you. They start bands, and you get a nice little scene going. Record companies start to take notice. They swoop in, they sign up the cream of the crop, and all of a sudden that type of music spills into another city. So without that happening now, the kids, what they have to do is, and it's a little bit easier, but a lot harder. Easy to make a great sounding record, easy to access people and kind of get your name out there. To me, the key ingredient that's missing, and there are some good bands, and I'm not saying there aren't any good bands, but the thing I feel like that's missing right now in music is emotional maturity. Like, kids now, because when by the time I got into the Ramones, I had been in the Marine Corps, I had been with women, I had drank and partied, and been out in the world on my own, and you know, like I was experienced in the world. You know what I mean? I had been through emotional stuff. I had, you know, done a lot of stuff. But these days, because of the way everything operates, it's so different than it was back then. Kids really are more in control of their lives, and I think, as far as I can tell, they're not like I grew up during the Cold War. Like, nuclear annihilation was always part of the equation. We had, you know, we had bands that based their entire
that's true
identity on that. Bands like Reagan Youth and stuff like that really were like,
I still love, you know, Reagan Youth, well, even though they were like politically very socialist, like great band.
Yeah. Yep. But, you know, all those bands were like, you know, kind of apocalyptic, you know, we're going to go to war with Russia and we're all going to die. Kids these days don't live with that type of stuff. And they, like, my son's 21. He still lives at home. And I know my son isn't different than any of my friends' kids. You know, most of my friends' kids, they're living at home at a period in their lives when I was already gone and out and doing things. So without that kind of like that well to draw from, like, you know, having done all the crazy stuff that you do when you're young, I think that music is kind of right now is kind of a little bit stale and boring.
Like uninspired.
Yeah, really uninspired. And the kids look great. They you know, they have all the moves down, and they write, you know, cool hooky songs and stuff. But there's just that little part of the equation that's missing, so that it really comes off as a like a clone of the original without the spirit or the anger, and that's, you know, that's the only thing that I see that's missing from the equation. Because otherwise, the kids now, way better players than I was when I was, even when I made it to the Ramones. I see kids that play now that are like unbelievable musicians because they studied piano since they were 6 years old, or their school had a great music program and stuff like that. Opportunities that I didn't have when I was a kid. So in some ways, it's a lot cooler. It's a lot better. But in other ways, it's just there's that little piece missing.
It doesn't have the edge.
Like a kid band breaking big now, they're only limited by their own motivation and their own creativity. Because that's the beautiful thing. With the internet, you have access to so much.
Yeah.
You can access huge groups of people. You just got to figure out how to do it.
What you're saying about these bands, it's reminding me so much, to be honest. I don't know how you feel about them, of that band Greta Van Fleet. I mean, they're like the biggest thing in rock right now for like a younger band, which is cool. But like, I listen to them and I'm like, this just sounds like, how could we sound just like Led Zeppelin? There's just nothing about it that's, like innovative or dangerous to me. And all the bands I like had something innovative or dangerous to them. Like the Ramones, Motley Crue, like these bands sounded like nothing before. And it was edgy. And I feel like nothing is edgy today.
Yeah. Well, you know, it goes back to, Greta Van Fleet's a great that's a great example because they are hugely talented. The kid has got an unbelievable voice. All the players in the band are really great. But there's just that one thing missing, and it's that real emotional depth, you know, like that well to pull off of when you're playing or when you're singing, that you really tap into, and that power, that energy is what the fans gravitate towards and they latch onto. Van Fleet is great to listen to, but they don't move me. They don't make me want to stand up and pump my fist. They make me want to listen. I'm like, wow, this kid's got a great voice, you know, but that's it. That's all they got, you know?
Have you seen that documentary by any chance on Oasis that's on Netflix? I think it's called, it's something Supernova. Have you seen it? Not Supernova, or, because I know they had Champagne Supernova, and then they had that other song.
I've heard of it, I think it's something documentary. I have not watched it, though.
You'd probably like it, man, but what you're saying, or what we said earlier, really what you said about the internet and all that, and the cool thing about that documentary is they were at the height of right before the internet was massive. So they talk about the very end of that documentary is Oasis playing Wembley Stadium. And this show was so massive that apparently 10% of the population of England tried to get tickets to that show. I mean, which is insane when you think about it. And they were like, there will never be anything like this again, because this was like 1996, I believe. And they were like, it was just such an organic thing where if your band was huge and you were played on every radio station and played on MTV, it was like a huge deal. And there's nothing like that anymore because of the internet. And I think everybody is like into their own little thing. There's no band that's on the level of an Oasis was in 1996.
And is it possible for a band to get that big in this day and age?
I don't think so.
That's the key. Jackie, you definitely hit it. That is really the key. Is it possible to make it happen on that level anymore? There really aren't many new artists that come up that will achieve that Justin Timberlake or that Oasis level. It's just a really strange time period. It really is. But the thing about Oasis, though, is they had fire, man. A friend of mine worked for them. My old tech worked for them for a little while. His first experience with them was he had to meet the tour bus at a hotel. So he gets to the hotel ahead of time. The bus pulls up, the doors open, and the two brothers spill out onto the driveway, beating the shit out of each other. And he was like full on punching each other in the face. And that's, you know, and as bad as that sounds and everything else, that is exactly the type of fire I'm talking about. And it doesn't have to be rational. It doesn't have to be well thought out or intelligent. But there has to be some kind of fire.
Yeah.
There has to be something that fuels the music.
It's so funny, too, because you see that from the documentary. These guys hated each other. It was so heated in the studio. And then when Oasis would get on stage, they barely even move around. It's really weird. They have a stage presence just standing there. They don't have to dance. They don't have to move around. They just stand there, and it is rock and roll.
And I'll tell you, and they wrote some great songs too,
absolutely,
man. They, regardless of whether or not, you know, you're a fan of that style of music, the stuff that they wrote really was catchy and really good.
I couldn't agree more. And I agree. They were like one of those last great rock bands. And I should say before getting into the next topic, the weird thing is like the rock stars in a way of today, and it's just so strange, are these EDM stars, electronic dance music, for people who don't know. I mean, if you watch that documentary on Avicii before he unfortunately passed away, one of these DJs, I mean, he is playing soccer stadiums full of people and he's on his laptop, and it's weird to a lot of people, but like that is the new rock star.
Yeah,
it's funny. I was kind of unaware of that whole scene for a long time. After the Ramones retired, I started a family and I left music for a while. And I was actually working as a doorman at a club in Manhattan.
Wow.
It used to be a church, and it became a big rock club during the 80s. And then it became a dance club. I was working one New Year's Eve, and I was doing security for the DJ that they brought in. He was some famous dude from Europe, and the guy was getting paid $150,000 to play a 1 hour set.
Holy shit.
On New Year's Eve, $150K for a 1 hour set on New Year's Eve. And I was, so here I am. My time with the Ramones was done. I'm working as a doorman in a club, and I'm watching this kid stand there with a laptop playing music for I didn't even make $150,000 a year with the Ramones. It was definitely a teachable moment. Right?
And I say this as someone who's a big fan of electronic music and grew up listening to Nine Inch Nails and then later industrial dance music. But EDM just doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah. I think the last kind of, I liked Ministry and Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, Ministry
about
is
as
awesome.
Close to that type of music as I got. But I hear what you're saying. There's some stuff you just can't relate to. You know what I mean? It's either you did the drugs in that scene and you hung out and danced to it, or you don't get it.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely a different scene than the one today. I mean, a guy who worked for this company before, and you guys have seen his work, Nick Cahill, is like very into that whole scene. And he was doing photography for this EDM artist, Seven Lions, here in the city and was touring with him. And Nick invited me out and Brandon Webb, and I got to see Seven Lions. And I'll be honest, I had a great time. I mean, it's not what I would normally listen to all the time, but I wouldn't say I don't get it. It's not that I personally don't get it, because I do on some level. It's fun music. It's exciting. People like to dance and have a great time.
But it lacks that innovation and that danger that you guys were both talking about.
Yeah, and it's also like, I saw Van Halen, for example, on their last tour, which I think was like 3 years ago. No guy on a laptop is going to move me as much as seeing like Eddie Van Halen doing a solo.
I hear that,
Me, you know?
I got to tell you, though, When I first started at that club, they always start you out in the worst position, which is the dance floor, because you're dealing with people who are just out of their minds at that point. So, I had never heard any type of dance club music at that time. I was totally unfamiliar with it. But standing out on the dance floor with the music going and the lights going, watching everybody else move, I couldn't help but kind of just lean back a little bit and sway. It's fun, even though I had no experience with it, none, but it's just anything, I think, you know, dance music, that's what it's made to make you move, you know what I mean? So you get out in the club, you start feeling that beat coming out loud out of the speakers, everyone else is dancing, you kind of just tend to lean back and sway a little bit. It's kind of funny. I don't know how Ramones fans would feel about me standing there dancing to the house music, but I couldn't help it.
No, for sure. Yeah, I think you have to be kind of in the moment. And, I think people are kind of quick to say, like, oh, I don't get this. But if you're actually there, it might not be what you listen to on a regular basis. But, you know, it's...
And real honestly, like, the drugs has a lot to do with it.
I think,
everybody in the place was taking ketamine or, you know, PMP or some kind of crazy, you know, club drug. And that's really, that music is written to stimulate the same part of the brain that the drug does, you know? So it kind of goes together. It's like, if you sit down and listen to like Pink Floyd, Saucer Full of Secrets, straight, you would be like, what is this crap? But you smoke weed and sit down and listen to it, and you're like, oh man, this is the greatest stuff I ever heard. And some music is just, it goes hand in hand with drugs, and otherwise it just don't sound that great.
Yeah, and it's the light show and all that goes with it as well.
But right.
I wanted to get into what you're actually up to. You were telling me that you have an upcoming book. I want to hear about that. And then you have a pretty... Yeah. giant announcement that you said you're going to make for the first time with us, which I'm pretty honored by, but let's get into it.
Yeah. So the book I've been working on for a long time. It's really been a long time, but it's a strange thing. I never wrote before. And, so when I sat down to do it, I didn't know even really how you should do it, but I just sat down and started doing it. I was working on it with somebody else in the beginning. I didn't kind of like the way it was going, so I just said, hey, I'm going to do it myself. And I started writing, and I had a weird thing happen. Like, it started, I started writing about stuff from my past that I kind of never put to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought up, like, weird emotions, and all of a sudden I just, like, I couldn't, like, I just stopped writing. Like, I was like, yeah, I don't feel like dealing with that. But I couldn't continue writing. I couldn't jump past it because in my obsessive compulsive brain, I can only do it in chronological order. So I hit this like weird spot where I'm just like, you know, what do I do? What do I do? So I've been talking to a couple other guys who are writers and getting some good advice from them and trying to, you know, and they told me, they're like, you know, it should be cathartic. You should be working through stuff. It should be making you feel something. If it's not, if you're not getting upset or happy or whatever, as you're writing about your life, then it's not going to be good.
Yeah.
It's like we were saying before, there's got to be that spark, that creative spark. So that's kind of helped me get by it. And I'm doing it a little bit out of time, but I was hoping to maybe get it out with my last record. But it's probably going to be a little while longer before I'm actually done with it. But, yeah, it's not a real simple thing to kind of sit down and write things out and look at everything that you've done and been through in your life, especially when you try to be honest and include the stuff that you're not proud of. You know what I mean? If anybody could sit down and write about the highlights of their life, but I'm being honest and I'm writing about the stuff that I ain't too proud of either.
Yeah, no, I went through the exact same thing because I you know, recently wrote a memoir, and it's the same. It's like we were saying earlier in the podcast, you don't want to just glorify war and talk about, you know, the flag waving and how great you are. Yep. I mean, anybody can write a book about how great they are. I mean, that's easy to do, but to write a book about all the things you fucked up, like that gets difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And especially coming to, you know, I think most people like to think that at some point in your life, you know, you can go back and, you know, fix mistakes you made or do things differently. And, you know, everyone likes to think that, oh, I only make, I only make mistakes once and I never repeat them. But when you sit down and you start looking and you know, like I noticed patterns in my life, like self-destructive patterns and stuff like that, like things that I went through. And I'm like, man, how did I never see that? How did I keep doing that one stupid thing over and over and cursing myself for it every time, or even worse, blaming somebody else for it? But it's an interesting process if you're doing it correctly.
Is there any crazy story you could tell us from the book, like that, you know, because I want to hear this now.
So let's see. All right, let me think of a good one. Well, one thing I've struggled with, and it's been my biggest regret, is how I separated from the Marine Corps. You know, I ended up a deserter. I was, by the time I finished the Ramones auditions and everything else that I was going through to get into the band, I was a deserter.
Wow.
And you want to talk about living with something that you can never change, you know? And, you know, my DD-214, my reenlistment code, when Ground Zero happened, when 9/11 happened, first thing I did was run down to the recruiter, brought my DD-214. He looked at it and he said, you can never serve again.
Wow. Because you went AWOL?
That's some serious regret. And you know, and admitting to that, like on your show, I know there's guys out there, and I've gotten shit even from some friends of mine who have served. That's why on my Twitter feed or on my IG feed in my little profile, I never list USMC. I didn't fulfill my contract and I ended up a deserter. I don't feel like I should be listing that. You know what I mean? That's just how I feel about it. But that's the kind of stuff that came up when I was writing that I hit the wall hard on, and it made me, it kind of made me take a step back and have to really rethink things and try to put some of it to bed.
Yeah, that I can see that being tough to move on from, and how it'd be one of those things that you'd end up regretting. But you know, I was telling Ian, you know, today, unfortunately, we have a real tendency to eat our own as well. And, you know, there does come a point where you personally have to put some of these things to bed, but like we collectively also have to like, you know, okay, this guy made a mistake. Like, we're moving on. Like, are you going to hold it against this guy for, I think even somebody who goes AWOL or somebody like we call it RFS who gets released for standards from Ranger Battalion. Like, okay. Right. Like you probably did something to fuck up, but you got a whole rest of your life to live. Like you may live another 60 years, buddy. You know, you got to move on with that.
That's the truth. The truth. And you know, the point that I came to was like, hey, I can either, you know, sit around and you know, and cry and whine about it. You know what I mean? And be embarrassed or try to hide it or whatever. Or I can just, you know, take a step back and make it make me better for what I'm doing next. And I'll tell you, if I was never in the Marine Corps, I would never have made it in the Ramones. Because before I went into the Marine Corps, I was a total shitbird. I didn't want to do anything but party and act stupid. I didn't care what anybody, you know, I didn't care about anything. I literally cared about nothing. So when I went to the audition and I was talking to Johnny, the first one, I realized, Johnny said to me something about him going to, Johnny went to military school when he was younger. And it really was kind of an instant connection for me and Johnny. But because I came out of the Marine Corps with discipline and being self-motivated and not, you know, crumbling when things got tough, that's what allowed me to last in the Ramones. Mm-hmm. And I told Johnny from the get-go, I said, I knew they had gone through a lot with Dee Dee being a drug addict and Mark being an alcoholic and Joey having mental problems and being an alcoholic. I knew that inside there was a lot of turmoil. So I figured that's going to be part of my job, is to be like a stabilizing force. And that's exactly what I did. And that's how I went out. I learned 40 Ramone songs in 5 weeks. I never gave them a hassle about anything. Anytime we were supposed to be there, I was there 15 minutes ahead of everybody else. I did all the legwork for recording records, as far as figuring out songs and teaching them to Johnny and learning all the lyrics. And I just got down to the job of being CJ Ramone. But I went at it like how I was taught in the Marine Corps. I went at it 100% without any doubt in my abilities, and that's what kept me in the band. So had I never gone into the Marine Corps, I would have never lasted in the Ramones. I may have got the audition, but I would have gotten kicked out.
Well, that's why so many employers love to hire former Marines, because they can bring you guys on and have you work 18-hour days and you won't say shit about it.
Yep. That's the truth. And so things like that, like looking at it from that perspective, it helps me to like understand, like, there was a reason that I was in the Marine Corps. There was a reason why I went there. In the larger picture, it probably saved my life.
Well, you want to hear,
and it definitely made me the man I am. I would not be who I am right now had I never been in the Marines.
You know, I was telling Ian also that this is really sad. I know people who have Sterling Records, who were more professional than I ever was, who have more professional accomplishments than I do, totally legit veterans, guys who served in special operations. And they have seen how toxic the veterans community has become in a lot of ways, to the point that they will not publicly talk about being a Ranger or a Green Beret.
Yep.
Or it's almost like they almost have this little kind of shame about it that they won't talk about it because they're like, you know, the community will just come after you and tear you apart and professionally try to ruin you over just the smallest thing. They just hear something maybe they don't like and they accuse you of stolen valor or whatever. And it's just a really toxic environment where we should be very supportive of one another. Sometimes it's like that, but a lot of times it isn't.
Yeah. I mean, this is going back a couple of years. I think when Brandon released his first book and I went to the party in New York City for it. And I think that's when I met you, Jack.
Yeah, too. I think so.
And I first met you guys and I met a bunch of guys there and it was like everybody there was like really, really like in good spirits. And it was like, everyone was really excited for you guys. And it was cool to have like veterans doing something, that other veterans could be a part of and get involved in and support. And then I kind of watched like what happened. So I think I've been around for a pretty long time with you guys and I've followed pretty closely. But I've seen like some of the stuff that's happened on the periphery with other vets, you know, getting on board with other organizations or other groups like yours, and they're talking like mad shit about everybody. And to me, anyway, it's like I get it. You know what I mean? An easy way to get yourself known and get a leg up really quick is to attack the guy on top.
But we're very competitive.
Some of the stuff that gets said and some of the stuff that gets drug out into the public is just wrong. And it shouldn't. It's just wrong. Like if some of the stuff that I've seen said through the press or in the media and stuff like that, I would never say about anybody else in the media. If I saw them, I would say it to their face. I would call them on it, but I would never, ever say it in the press because to me, that's just, you're trying to use the press to further yourself by bringing somebody else down. And that's just inherently wrong. That's just not the way a professional operates.
It's definitely a strange world. And, you know, I sense that there are like becoming two types of veterans. There are like those guys who kind of just like get out, they go to college, start a family, move on. And then there are the other guys who just kind of exist in that like vet bro world and they wear, you know, the paraphernalia everywhere they go. And they're constantly reminding everyone that they're a veteran. It's strange. And unfortunately, a lot of good guys, like I said, they just kind of like bow out of it and they like won't even tell people that they served in the military, which is it's a damn shame, really.
Yeah. It's, you know, to me, it should always be a part of who you are and what you do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I've tried to do. I've just tried to make sure that when I have a job or responsibility, I go at it like I was taught to, because I know that that's the way to get good results quick. It's just to go at it hard and 100%. And I consider, you know, those 2 years a really important part of my life, but it don't define me and it isn't all I am.
Right.
You know, and that's, I think I'm agreeing with what you're saying 100%. You know, you can't hang your identity on one thing. You can't hang your whole life on one thing. You look at the vets that come home after World War II or Korea or even Vietnam. They came home and got down to the business of having families and all of that good stuff. Like you're saying, a lot of guys do that now, but it just seems like now there's a lot more guys who kind of are like fighting hard to hold on to it. So I think in some instances for no other reason than for monetary gain.
Yeah.
They just see a way to exploit having been in the military to make money.
The professional veteran.
And that's, and I don't fault anybody for that. If that's your thing, but you got to do it in a professional way, not by tearing down your fellow vets or, you know, trying to, like I said before, get a leg up on another veteran run business by shooting them down to make your business look better.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to save this for the book release, but I'm certainly wondering, I'm sure the audience is wondering. Yeah, and like I said, you obviously could save this for when the book comes out, but why you allowed your military career to end like that?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the easiest way for me to put it is, I mean, realistically, what would you rather do? Which is that I was a Cold War warrior. There was nothing going on, literally nothing going on. And I could have either spent the next 2 years digging fighting holes, you know, miserable, probably. Well, actually, when I left, I was actually about to go, head over to Iwakuni, Japan. So I could have went and spent 2 years over in Iwakuni, Japan, the next 2 years in Iwakuni, Japan, or I could have spent 2 years touring with the Ramones.
So that is essentially the reason you left, though. You got the call while you were in the Marines.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I think it's understandable. That's a pretty...
I auditioned for the Ramones while I was in the Marine Corps.
So, I mean, that puts a totally different spin on it. I think a lot of guys, if they... Because you have talked about it before, you were a Ramones fan. You grew up with that music. You know, if you got a call to tour with, like, in a sense, your idols and become a new member of the band, it's a pretty hard thing to pass up because, you know, you have to fulfill this contract. I personally fully understand.
I'll tell you, the thing that makes it a little bit extra kind of salty for me, though, is my my dad's family. Everyone served. My dad and his oldest brother, both in Navy. My Uncle Kenny was Army Airborne, fought in Korea. So it's kind of military service was a part of the family. I don't know, that's a people like, if I hear that one more time, blah, blah, blah. But Long Island, I think per capita, has the largest amount of people who serve in the nation. I think that's the stat that I heard, that Long Island per capita has more people in the service than any other part of the United States. So so my family's no different. You know, everybody, all my dad's family served. So that made it even a little bit more harder, you know, in hindsight, was that my dad was in for, Vietnam and the Cuban Missile Crisis. My Uncle Kenny was a merchant marine in the early years of World War II, and then joined the Navy for the last year. And like I said, my Uncle Kenny was a Korean War vet. So I'm my military record in with the rest of my family is really an extra little bit of embarrassment for me. But like I said, you know, that's really what it came down to. When I went to the audition strictly just to go down and meet the band. But when I got the callbacks and call back again, and suddenly I realized I might get this gig.
That's a crazy story, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, had you have done the thing that you regret on some level, I mean, you wouldn't be CJ Ramone. You'd be Chris Ward. And, you know, I mean, something else may have happened, but
my plan at that point was, I figured I'd go into the Marine Corps. And I went in guaranteed infantry. My recruiter was like, why would you want to go in guaranteed infantry? And I told him I grew up hunting and I know guns and I know rank is pretty easy to pick up in infantry. And I had all these justifications for it. And I went in and I was a 31, and I figured I'd go in and do, you know, maybe 8 years and come out and try to get on emergency services with New York City Police Department. And that was my goal. That was my big plan. But yeah, fate kind of stepped in. You know, had I not enlisted, had I just waited another 2 more years and kept playing in clubs, like I said, I probably would have got the audition anyway, but I still firmly believe I would not have been able to maintain my spot in the band.
Right.
I think that the Marine Corps made that possible.
That's an awesome story, man. People are probably excited for the book. Now on to the other big announcement that you said you haven't talked about anywhere else. I'll let you get right into it.
So a couple years back, you know, like I said, I was gone from music for a good long while, and I was just kind of being the family guy and working a regular job. And so 2008, I started playing again, and I'm big on like 5-year plans. I'm like that kind of guy. Like I try to, that's how I keep my life somewhat organized. So when I first came back, I was loving it. It was great. And I, you know, 2012, I did a new record, and then I started thinking about like, you know, what I'm going to do in the future. What am I, you know, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And I need to have like some kind of plan. And I had said it, I had in my mind, I said that when 2020 comes, I'm going to retire. And so I got down in business of releasing records 2012, 2014, and 2017, now 2019, my fourth record. And 2020 is around the corner. So this will probably be my last record is CJ Ramone.
Wow.
And I plan on stopping touring at the end of 2020.
How does that feel, man? I mean, are you like burned out on touring at this point, or are you gonna, is it something you're really gonna miss?
No, you know, there's just other things I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and music's been, I've been pretty much playing music and playing shows since I'm 13 years old. I started, you know. And there's just other things I really want to do. I really want to try, you know, I really want to try writing. I want to do that. Growing up on Long Island, you know, you go up around fishing boats and the ocean and all that. I've always wanted to have my own fishing boat. I've always wanted to captain a boat and just be able to go out and catch fish and relax and kick back. You know, there's just other things I want to do. And as, like you said before, you know, I tour a lot. And for every day I'm on the road, there's probably 3 days of prep.
Yeah.
Literally. There's probably 3 days of prep. And it really has taken up, it's really since 2008. I mean, I've been hitting it hard, and it's really taken up a good portion of my life. So I think, I think it's good. I don't want to be Keith Richards. You know what I mean? I could still get up on stage and hit it pretty hard and have fun. I mean, I'd like to have Keith Richards' money. I just don't want to get up there with my face looking like an old catcher's mitt, you know, with other musicians covering for me and stuff. That's just, it's just not my thing.
No, good for you.
And, so that's what I'm going to do, but I'm definitely going to give writing a shot. I love to, I've enjoyed writing my book. I Jack will tell you on News Rep. I mean, I comment on just about every story that you guys write. I really appreciate the writers. The story and the content is always awesome, but you can have a great story and great content and your delivery is crap and you blow it.
True.
But you guys have had, you guys have done a really good job at picking writers who really know how to nail it. And it's kind of inspired me to give it a shot myself. So I'd love to try it, you know, and I like it. While I know it'll never, you know, I'm not looking for it to pay the bills or something. Like that's kind of where I could see myself, in my later years is doing a bunch of little things.
That's
I'd
great.
Like to own an Irish pub. Yeah, that's the other thing I want to do.
Really?
My son went to school for culinary arts, and so I've been talking to my wife about maybe opening up a little Irish joint, and, you know, good whiskey, tap beers, small plate food, you know, put my son in the kitchen. That's my, seems like a nice
that's
way
great.
To spend my lady years.
Well, please keep us in mind, and we can publish some excerpts of your book if you'd like when the time comes.
Oh, that'd be cool.
And help out with the promotion when you're ready to publish.
All right, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate that.
Awesome, man. So it sounds like, you know, for people who want to see you live, this is like a last shot
yeah.
to see you on tour. which, you know, the new tour is going to start next month with the Mean Jeans. This is like a West Coast run. I assume you're going to do some more international dates and East Coast dates.
We're going to do a West Coast run, and then I'm actually standing in on bass for Me First and the Gimme Gimmes.
Oh, I know of. They do all those, like, cover songs of, like, old movies, right? You know?
Yeah.
But they do punk rock versions.
Cover songs from all different time periods. But I'm gonna. So my tour, my West Coast run, ends on the 10th. The 12th, I fly to Europe with them. I play with them from June 12th through July 6th. Then my band flies over, meets me in Brussels. Our tour takes off July 10th. We pick up. And then we go through till August 3rd. Then we fly into New York, and we start making our way west from there back home to San Francisco. Later on this year, we got offers to go to South America. We're looking at Japan. I'm hoping to record a live record over in South America later this year. That's something I'd like to do. That's the other thing. There'll be at least two more releases, a live record and then a Green Stage record.
That's awesome. What were you saying?
And then 2020, we'll probably get out on the road and, I'll probably hit the States and Canada really hard, trying to make a couple of the other territories like Australia and New Zealand that I want to get to before it's all over. And end of 2020, that'll be it.
That's awesome. Wow. So that's a pretty long, extensive tour. The thing I'm wondering, I've actually never seen you play live. So what percentage of the set is your own solo stuff, and what percentage is Ramon's material?
I probably do 60-70% of my own stuff, and the rest is Ramon's stuff.
Like greatest hits, Ramon's? Like, you know, I Want to Be Sedated and all that?
I usually pull out a couple of different fan favorites. Per show, you know, I try to throw a couple of oddball songs in there just for the real serious deep cut style Ramones fans.
Awesome, man.
Cool.
So once again, May 10th on Fat Records, The Holy Spell, then the corresponding tour. And then also this weekend, if people are in the New Jersey area, you're going to be back at the New Jersey Horror Con and Film Festival. I don't know if that's one you've done before. Yeah. You've done a few cons, though, recently, and this is at the Showboat Hotel Atlantic City. Tickets up at Eventbrite.com. So I'm assuming you're signing stuff and meeting Ramones fans.
Yep. Yeah, those things are actually pretty fun. I've done a couple of them over the last year, and had a good time at them, and I've got to meet a bunch of really cool people, you know, from different TV shows, movies, other bands. It's actually pretty cool.
I love the picture of you with Carmen Electra at one of them, and Carmen Electra's wearing a Ramon shirt.
Yeah, good stuff, man. It's a lot of fun.
Nice. Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. We'll do this again sometime, and people who want to follow you on Twitter and Instagram, which you're very active on, it's at the THEE CJ Ramon, both on Twitter and Instagram, at the CJ Ramon. I think we've covered a lot, man. And anything else before we wrap this up?
Nah, that'd be it. You guys keep doing what you're doing, man. I'm a big fan, and I follow you guys religiously, so keep it up.
Yeah, thank you, CJ. It really means a lot to me, and I know it means a lot to the other guys as well, and I really appreciate you, you know, taking an hour or so out of your day for us today.
All right, guys.
Thanks, man.
Take care.
I had no idea he was going to get into that story, because I sort of knew a little bit of it, but it's like, it's a weird thing to kind of carry that regret with you when it's a completely understandable situation. I mean, I think 9 out of 10 guys, if they were given the opportunity to be in a band that they, legends really, that they grew up on, and be able to take the spot of a guy who's no longer in the band, I mean, I think they would do it.
As opposed to feeling like you're not really doing anything in the military at the time. But, you know, the Marines are pretty hardcore, and, you know, I think the regret comes from, want, you know, making that commitment and not following through on it. And then that's something that, you know, followed him around the rest of his life. Like, he was saying he was trying to reenlist after 9/11. They're like, sorry, bro.
Yeah.
But I'm glad he talked about that, and I'm glad he's writing about it, because, you know, that's what I've said in the past, or what we were talking about just now, is when you write about those kinds of regrets, that actually is usable content that the reader can take away.
Yeah.
That's something that an 18-year-old kid reading that, it'll make him think, like, maybe I don't want to make the same mistake that CJ Ramone feels he made when he was a young guy.
Yeah.
So there's actually, like, some, you know, lessons you can learn by talking about that stuff.
I'm sure the book is filled with other mistakes, but it's weird. I don't know if I would necessarily see that as a mistake, because, as he says, he just went to these auditions to meet the guys.
Yeah.
Never thought he would get the call back. And I mean, I think in some ways, wouldn't the bigger mistake have been serving out his contract and he never gets this giant opportunity to do what he
did? I mean, I don't about? I don't, that's all, like, totally subjective,
yeah,
you know, based on how you feel about it. Like, some people would be like, yeah, fuck the military, who gives a shit?
And it would be a weirder regret to be like, yeah, I could have been in the Ramones. Instead, I had a really mundane military career.
Yeah, no, I can understand it.
Yeah. But always great having him on. Go see him on tour. I definitely will try to, because when he plays New York, knowing that this will be likely the last time we'll get to see him. And I totally understand it. I mean, CJ's not, like, a young guy anymore, and he's carrying on that Ramones legacy. He's one of the few guys left from the, you know, not the original band, but that were in the actual band, carrying on the legacy of that music. I mean, everybody knows I Want to Be Sedated and all these great songs. And, I mean, such an awesome thing to be a part of that. You know what? We do have some emails to get to. Before we get to them, I do want to let you know what we have going on at Hurricane. So let me do that real quick. Please check out Crate Club as always. And we have a special promo code I'll give for you guys. It's a club for men, by men, of gear handpicked by special operations veterans. We have the Dash One Crate, the Pro Crate, and for those looking for the holy grail of gear subscriptions, our Premium Crate. These are all available at crateclub.us. And right now we are running an extremely limited promotion of 20% off for all Soft Rep Radio listeners. So I was just on the phone with Adam Haddad from our company who runs all this stuff. And we were talking about hooking the listeners up with a big discount. So he was telling me this is the biggest discount we've ever made available. And we don't know how long we can keep this promotion live. So get on it right now. It's crateclub.us. Use the coupon code SOFREP and you'll get 20% off any gearbox. Sign up today. Once again, that's crateclub.us. Coupon code is SOFREP. 20% off any of those gearboxes. So that's huge. And I don't know how long it's going to last. So get on it. Also, as a reminder for those listening, now is the time to sign up for the Spec Ops channel. That's our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. Again, you can watch this content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a membership for only $4.99 a month. That's specopschannel.com. Sign up today. And last, if you're not already signed up at the News Rep, you've got to get on board. Expert reporting and actionable intelligence from your favorite writers you've heard on here, like Jack Murphy, of course, George Hand, Collins, Joe LaFave, and the many great guest writers who pop up on there as well. Unlimited access to News Rep on any device, unlimited access to the app, join the War Room community, invitations to our exclusive events. It's all ad-free for members. We have a trial offer up right now where you can get 4 weeks for only $199. Sign up at thenewsrep.com. That's thenewsrep.com, where you can get 4 weeks for only $1.99. Great offer to get introduced to what we're doing at the News Rep, thenewsrep.com. Sign up today. By the way, for those not in the know, we have our own Soft Rep Radio app that you can download for free on iPhone or Android. You just look up the Soft Rep Radio app right on there and has all our episodes, all the back episodes. And our homepage, of course, is softrepradio.com, where you can see that full archive of shows and keep up with us, of course, at Soft Rep Radio. With that, I have a few emails sent to softrep.radio.
One thing, Ian, yeah. I was pulling statistics out of thin air before. Black population in America, 2010 census data, is 12.6%.
Okay, yeah. So it's, as you're saying, lower than people.
Lower than, I think, what a lot of New Yorkers would for imagine. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so I have some emails sent to softrep.radio@softrep.com here. And by the way, ever since we did that Q&A episode, like, we're getting a ton of emails.
Really?
Yeah, so we may have to do another Q&A in a few months. It was enjoyable. I mean, we went long.
No, it's enjoyable. Okay.
But, like, these are only three of, like, 20-something emails
Holy
in the
shit.
Past week. So I thought these were, like, the best ones, or the best, like, brief questions we can get to. This is from Joseph Parrish. I was listening to a clip from a Pat McNamara interview. I assume he's thinking of the Joe Rogan one because we certainly didn't talk about this with Pat. And he says the topic was Red Wings and the lack of truth told regarding what happened. No 5.56 brass. Marcus had full magazines, 11, etc. My question is, how were his teammates killed and who killed them? I think it's sort of self-explanatory, as we were saying before we got to this, and that's from Joseph Patrick.
I mean, they were killed by the Taliban.
Yeah.
Firefight.
I think that this goes back to people who have a very, conspiratorial view of what went down.
Oh, boy.
But listen back, I was going to say.
I have no idea what Pat McNamara interview he's talking about there.
It's probably Rogan, but I haven't heard it yet.
Yeah,
so.
I haven't heard it, so I can't really comment on that.
Yeah, I would say if you want to hear the full story, though, of what truly went down from the video footage and everything, listen back to our first interview with Ed Derrick, and I'm going to tell you what episode that is.
Yeah, both of those interviews are really good.
Yeah, the first one, those were where we really got into it, so that's 315. The Truth Behind Extortion 17.
Which is a separate incident, but I mean,
we talked about
Red Wings a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and he gets into what really went down, and we got some backlash for it.
Did we?
Negative reviews of people, that don't like the fact that what Ed says doesn't correspond with what Marcus Luttrell said, but it's the truth of the matter.
I mean, facts hurt sometimes. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, so listen back to that one. All right, this one I thought was really interesting because of the fact, really, that it goes to, there's new people discovering this podcast all the time who are just discovering, special ops military culture and everything in it. So you guys, some of you will probably laugh at this email, but I thought it'd be interesting just to read because it shows the background of some of our listeners. Hey guys, literally just listened to my first podcast today by y'all. A question not directly related to any show, but here it goes. I and many people in North America, Asia, and Europe have really gotten into the sport of airsoft, a sport very similar in idea to paintball, but a much more realistic simulated sport. Many skirmishes or mil sims, military simulations, consist of actual objectives and structures, replica firearms utilizing actual real steel accessories, pyrotechnics, and even helicopters and vehicles. Anyways, I've heard a lot of people in the military dislike this sport because it is trying to simulate combat, but I've heard some, like in the video games attached below, who have used it, and he attached to video games, used it to keep their skills and training and allow them to teach others. What is your opinion on this or any, quote, simulation of combat? And then he sends a video to give you a sense of airsoft. The thing is, I think almost all of our audience is familiar with airsoft.
Yeah.
We're certainly familiar with it. I do think a lot of airsoft guys get a lot of crap, but then there's guys in the community that we're really good friends with, like Red in Utah and Ajax and those guys in Utah. And like, they're very cool guys who have a great respect for the military, come from military families like Red. And there's definitely a crossover.
Yeah, Red's a character. I love him. I don't have any issue with airsoft. I'm not involved in it personally, but I mean, if people want to go out and shoot each other with paintballs and pellets, on the weekend, it's not doing me any harm. I don't think it's doing the military any harm.
Yeah.
So if that's what you do for fun, then enjoy it,
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with that. And I'll give a plug to Rad here. Rad is at Rad Rockin on Instagram. And if you're into airsoft, he's like the guy.
He's your man.
Yeah, he loves it. He lives for it. And he's such a character, man. And just a super positive fun guy to be around, really. All right, here's the last one, which you said you're familiar with. This is from Taylor Johnson, and he's talking about Triple Frontier here. Hey, Ian and Jack, I got to hear what Jack has to say about the new Netflix movie about former soft dudes turning to crime. The movie's name is Triple Frontier and features some pretty big name actors. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, I watched the movie like a week or two ago when it came out, and I really liked it. I know I'm kind of like notorious for my movie reviews on the website because like I usually trash these movies so hard and just hate them.
But you usually trash the like Hollywood.
The Hollywood, yes.
Glamorizing.
Yeah, like Sicario. Like I hated that movie so much.
I think every military veteran I've ever talked to hated Zero Dark Thirty.
I hated that movie. That was just propaganda. It was just disgusting. But Triple Frontier, I mean, I liked it. Definitely a work of fiction, of course, and you know, keep that in mind when you watch it. It's not trying to be a true. It's not torn from the headlines. It's not based on a true story. It's a fictional film, and I really enjoyed it. It's about some kind of down and out special operations veterans. Again, it's not really glamorized. I thought it was pretty realistic, actually, in the sense that like these guys are kind of like burnouts. Like one guy was forced into retirement, and like Ben Affleck's character, and he's trying to sell condos, doing like real estate stuff, and he kind of sucks at it. And he has an ex-wife and a daughter that's kind of ambivalent about him. You know, the another guy who's a pilot, and he got popped for like smuggling cocaine or something like that. They're like they're all kind of like down and out, and they go and attempt to run this heist down in South America, stealing money from a drug lord and getting away with it. And a lot of people didn't like the movie because it's like they're all like special operations guys would never be so incompetent. They would never make these mistakes. And I'm read these reviews and I'm like, what do you mean we wouldn't make these mistakes? Of course we do. We make them all the time. So for me, the incompetence, the desperation, the mistakes they made, like all that kind of rang pretty true to me, you know? And it also goes back to that Jake Zwig interview we were doing where he's like, you know, special operations guys aren't good at crime necessarily because they work inside an institution. They are not career criminals. And so when they try to go and do crime, they fuck it up. And he brought it up an example of some support guys working for the SEALs who did a robbery. I have no knowledge of this myself, but he said they like went and robbed a bank in Virginia with suppressed MP5s right out of the armory.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's pretty obvious.
And then he said their language.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like when you execute a crime like that and it's with military precision, I wonder who that was. And like I brought up the subject of the Second Ranger Battalion guys who robbed a bank. And it's like, huh, right outside the base where Second Ranger Battalion is stationed, and these guys were very precise and seemed like their actions were rehearsed. And you know, okay, who could that have been? So I thought the film was pretty good. You know, some people have problems with it because they want, you know, a straight up like heroic adventure. But I thought it was kind of true to life. Like I watched it and I was like, yeah, I could see it going down like that more or less. You know, there's another heist movie out I think it's out. The one with the guy from Strike Back where he's a SEAL in Bosnia and they're trying to steal Nazi gold out of the bottom of this lake. I got to check and see if that movie is out. I don't want to watch it. That one looks like it's more lighthearted, you know, kind of a fun tone to it, but, I'm okay watching those fictional movies. Like I get a kick out of them. It's the ones that like try to be real, like Sicario, like they're trying to sell it to you. Like, yeah, this is real. This is how it is. And this is how it would go down. Like that stuff just gets fucking silly to me. Takes itself a little too seriously, maybe. I liked it. You should go check it out.
Yeah. All right. So check that out. As always, email us softrep.radio@softrep.com. We'll try to get to what we can. And next episode, we have Joe LaFave coming on. I'm very excited because we're going to do an episode all about the Oklahoma City bombing, which is a subject that has always fascinated me. I'm pretty knowledgeable about Tim McVeigh, read the book American Terrorist about Tim McVeigh. I've seen a few documentaries, including the documentary that was done kind of shortly after the bombing about the idea of a John Doe number two, as they called it, because originally John Doe number one was Tim McVeigh, and there was another person that they said assisted him. Terry Nichols was, of course, at home. He wasn't actually there. So he was the first person they made contact with. And we're going to talk about that conspiracy, which I do think is purely a conspiracy. And that was kind of cemented in the Oklahoma City documentary that's on Netflix that Mark Potok and Southern Poverty Law Center did. I went into it knowing him and Southern Poverty Law Center, expecting a little bit of a slant, which, you know, maybe slightly, but I thought it was actually pretty accurate. Of course, they do talk about the white supremacist angle of things, which Tim McVeigh, I don't believe, based on what I've read, was a white supremacist, but he met with those types of people at gun shows.
And yeah. He was anti-government, right?
For sure, yeah.
That was his thing.
And I think that those type of people congregated between gun shows and then when Waco happened and Ruby Ridge, all of these things basically got anti-government groups to come together. And Tim McVeigh was one of those people who felt very disenfranchised after his time in the military. And, you know, I'm interested in talking about it because the interesting thing about Tim McVeigh is, unlike a lot of people that you hear about who do these horrific acts, I don't think he was a crazy person or, you know, that he was someone who's mentally unstable. I think he probably, it's crazy to say, but if he never joined the military, I don't think he would have done anything like this. And he probably had, you know, it's from the things he saw, he acted extremely irrationally and did something horrific. And of course, there's no excusing what he did and the children who were killed. But I don't think he was a crazy person or anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a mistake to just jump to the conclusion that the person is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole other like little rant I could go into, and I probably haven't before. About, you know, the Nazis and the Holocaust. And it's a big mistake to think these people were all psychopaths. They're all insane. A lot of them were normal people.
Yeah.
And that's what's really scary about it.
Yeah. So, and connecting with Oklahoma City, as I said, is of course what happened in Waco with David Koresh. Mm-hmm. I've also read about that. I read the book, A Place Called Waco by David Thibodeau. And David was a member of, you know, the cult. He was in David Koresh's band, met David at Guitar Center. And it's really, to me, fascinating learning about these things. So it's always a topic that's interested me. So
we'll have to get into that. And I think McVeigh's service in the Gulf War and how he became disenfranchised with the United States is we'll have to talk about that stuff.
And then not becoming a Ranger. He was a guy who wanted to be a Ranger.
Oh, did he want to be a Ranger? Because I know he went to Special Forces Assessment and Selection.
That might be, yeah.
Yeah, he went and...
So he wanted to be a Green Beret. Yeah. So I could have that wrong.
And when I went to SFAS, the psychologist was talking about it because they administer psych evals to you in the course, in the selection screening. And he said, yeah, we still have McVeigh's test on record.
Wow.
And he said, if you go and look at it, you can tell there's something off about the guy.
And if I remember correctly, because I just saw it, the Netflix documentary, I don't think he physically was able to get through it either.
I can't remember if he got dropped or if he was a non-select at the end.
I think he was a non-select.
If he's a non-select, that's interesting because it means physically he was able to go through the entire course, but then they saw something in either the instructors assessed him that he would not be a good fit. That they saw either he wasn't a good team player or something popped up in that psychological exam that was a red flag. So if he was a non-select, that's very interesting. And that actually would also imply that, you know, the SFAS process is good and works, you know, that they did their job in screening him out.
Here we go. All right. So this is from the Chicago Tribune. McVeigh left the Gulf in April 1991, a month before his comrades, because he won a place in the Special Forces Assessment and Selection course at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. On the second day of the tryout, McVeigh withdrew from the program.
Okay. So he
frustrated by the rigorous
training. Voluntarily dropped out.
Yeah.
He couldn't hack it.
Yeah. And I think it was physically he couldn't do it, sounds like. Which, by the way, I just started reading your book. So he's kind of one of those guys that you talk about where they say, you know, hey, if you wanted, you've talked about it on the show, you can leave now. And guys started leaving.
You can quit now and still be a good American.
Yeah.
You go to another unit. Yeah.
I just started it. So I'm just, very early into the book, but it's good so far.
Man. Yeah.
I want people to check it out.
My book moves pretty quick. I was saying before, I don't spend a lot of time telling like basic training stories. By like page 10, I'm in Ranger indoctrination. By page 20, I'm in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So it moves right along.
Yeah, exactly. Cause I'm early on and you're already, you know, there doing all that. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting really deep into it and finishing it. I just finished before that Carmen Gentile's book, which I would recommend.
Yeah.
It was good. Yeah.
I went into the studio yesterday and did pickups for the audiobook. So the audiobook should be totally done for my memoir for Murphy's Law. And I had a meeting with the publicity people at Simon & Schuster. So they're already gearing up for all of that. It's all coming together.
Excellent. So at SoftRep Radio on Twitter and Instagram, check us out. And we'll be back next episode with Joe LaFave.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at SoftRep Radio.